You know the phrase, that's my story and I'm sticking to it? It's time to let that go. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, Dr. Bruce Leese joins us to discuss a person's life story as they tell it, to themselves and to others. He says if there's something you don't like about your own life story, you can re-reflect on it. By changing our personal narratives, we are no longer slaves to our past. We can have a better idea of our purpose here on Earth and get on a path to better mental health. Join us to hear how this plays out in all scenarios, including personal healing, being on a date, or writing a cover letter. That's all ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. City. Ever notice someone telling a story about a fishing or camping trip? Each time they tell it, the fish they caught or the wild bear they encountered gets bigger. Each time they tell it, there's a new detail to the narrative. Proof positive that our life experiences and our life stories aren't always consistent. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we discuss the psychology of the personal narrative, the motivations behind our life stories as we tell them, and to whom we tell them to. Once again with us to help us guide us through this thread, this narrative thread, is Dr. Bruce Leese, Professor of Family Medicine at KU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Leese, in a patient or client's history, there's always a case narrative or treatment narrative. In business, there's a process narrative. How do you define a narrative? What is it?
A narrative is it's your life story as you tell it. It's the way you tell it to yourself, what you say to yourself about who you are, and what you tell others about yourself. It's usually a more formalized process. You and I have talked about identity on this show, and it's your identity manifest. So what you put out there as who you are and what you've been through in your life.
Now, when you say a story you tell to yourself, what are you telling to yourself?
Well, it could be that you are unemployed and starting to feel kind of desperate, and you know that you're an extraordinary carpenter, but you're so worried about your income and your life that all of a sudden you start to think in your head, well, I'm also kind of a plumber. I'm an electrician also. I might even be able to do some computer programming. It's when you tell yourself, who you are, so that you then can tell the world, or you can manifest it out in the world. So we say to ourselves, you say to yourself, I'm a man. In our cases, you and me, I'm a father. I got to be who I am today because of all these things that have happened to me. So it's that story put together. And we're so complex as human beings. There are so many chapters and plots and subplots to our lives that any of the things we reflect on as to who we are all part of that story we tell ourselves.
So what we tell ourselves is the backstory, and then what we present in public is the character we want to present in that particular context.
Yeah, which brings to mind the concepts of real and ideal self. The ideal self is who I want to be, how I want to be perceived, and the real self is who I am and who I've become and how I operate in the world.
Where do our narratives begin?
Birth.
Birth.
Yeah, they certainly begin it. They begin at birth. When we are teeny and tiny, as we are treated by the world in one way or another, and we respond, that becomes our story. As we become conscious of ourselves, that's where the story really begins.
Now, if you're saying they begin at birth, what are the differences between our narratives as we experience them and then what we convey to others?
I would really like to believe that, by and large, people convey the truth about who they are to others. When I start talking to somebody, hopefully I feel good enough about my background, my life story, my narrative. Hopefully I feel good enough about it to really tell the truth, which isn't always the case. I gave the example of someone who might feel desperately unemployed, who may try to be somebody else. Another great example is when people start new romantic relationships. They often try to express a narrative that facilitates, let's just say, the development of that relationship. In other words, they try to put their best foot forward and impress the other person.
And so how do most people adapt their narratives to the sensibilities of others?
That really depends. A lot of narratives, a lot of how a narrative manifests, the way it comes forward, is the context. So if you're sitting on an airplane and the person next to you is friendly and warm and you don't have a good book to read instead or work to do, you may just start chatting with them, and you may just start pulling out different chapters of your life as they are relevant to the person sitting next to you. And you may say, yeah, I was once you might say you were once a model, a Speedo model. Hopefully, if you were, it would be true. You might say, I'm a journalist. How people decide to tell their story depends on the context.
Or you might say journalist/speedo model.
Exactly. Just what I was thinking. See, just what I was thinking was an example of an untrue narrative.
Right. Speaking of which, on previous programs, we've talked about lying and self-esteem versus self-interest. Both of those go into narratives. How often do we tweak a narrative to make ourselves look better? Meaning, not only am I a journalist, but I'm also former Speedo model as well. I do that too.
Some of the tweaking, some of the changes that occur over time are really innocent. I loved your introduction. The length of the weight or length of the fish you caught may change as a result of, wanting to leave a good impression or impress your friends, or it may truly be that you lose track. So many things affect the accuracy. I always warn people, if it's going to have implications for the rest of your life, don't change. Don't make believe you're somebody you're not. Do not present an identity that's untrue. So if you're going for a job or if you're dating someone, don't try to be someone you're not, because when you realize and they realize you're not, it will be painful to all involved.
You got that versus the folksy aspect of a minnow turning into a marlin on a fishing trip.
Oh, yeah, or a minnow turning into a skunk.
Are context and mood important in the way we relate our narrative?
Yeah, if a person is in a bad mood, or if they're in a context that is unpleasant, or if you want to take the opposite end, pleasant, or if they're in a good mood, it's because of the thoughts they have. I repeat it every time I have an opportunity. I'm what's known as a cognitive therapist. Cognitive meaning thought processes are premier, most important. So our narrative is what we think of ourselves. And if we're in a bad mood, we're thinking negative thoughts. Or if we're in a context that isn't comfortable, we're thinking probably uncomfortable thoughts. So what you're thinking puts you in a mood, and that mood will then filter what you think after that and what you may tell people about yourself. It would not probably be wise for me to sit here with you right now and be in a bad mood and think bad things. So I won't.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Speaking of which, as people actualize their bad thoughts, someone's standing in a baggage claim, for instance, and their bag comes off all messed up or their bag comes up missing, and they say something like, "This is the story of my life."
Right. Oh.
Talk about that.
I really like that you said that, because those are the kinds of little short phrases. That's my story and I'm sticking to it. This is the story of my life. Those are very telling short little phrases that do reflect a momentary automatic thought about oneself or about the world or about the future, the nature of reality. And if you grow up in such a way that you've had a lot of bad experiences, those thoughts become, is multitudinous a word? They happen too often. There are too many thoughts about how the world is a bummer. I think about the cartoon Ziggy. There's always a negative twist on something. I'm a victim. Bad things always happen to me. That's not a really good identity to have.
And people can come to define themselves by their calamities or by their tragedies or by their shortcomings or by things that have happened to them.
Right. And the awesome thing about good psychotherapy or good friendships or good relationships with you know, with anyone with wisdom, is that through the telling of one's own story, a good listener can, and a good, caring, compassionate listener can help the speaker, the narrative teller, the storyteller. You know, there might be another way to think about that. So the best example I can think of always is an abusive home, an abusive background, a lot of suffering in one's past can lead a person to think life is really awful, I can't trust anyone. Or it can give people the belief that life is difficult and I have compassion for everyone. I understand what suffering feels like, and so I'm in this world to help people to alleviate their suffering. So the same situations can lead to different life stories.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani Lafar. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lease, professor of family medicine at KU. We're talking about our life stories and how we tell them to ourselves and others. Kansas City, have you ever looked at your own life narrative and made changes to it? Do you want to change your life narrative? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org or on Twitter at KCURCST. Facebook is also an option as well. Dr. Lease, let's get into some scenarios of the business about how we go about telling some of these stories. On a date, for instance.
Most people who are in the process of dating are a little bit uncomfortable. So that's a really good scenario. So there's a little bit of anxiety in a normal person. A not-so-normal person goes out on dates and doesn't feel any kind of challenge or even slight threat to who they are. So that when somebody goes out on a date, they really want to do well. They want to be perceived in a positive way. Exceptions would be when it's obvious that it's not going to work and a person doesn't care as much after a few minutes. But in that scenario, people want to put their best foot forward and they want to create a self through their narrative about themselves that is impressive. So that's normal. Again, the danger in that is if you can't live up to it, life can be real painful when real and ideal come crashing into each other.
Speaking of real and ideal, what about the cover letter or the job application?
Great example.
Interview as an example of that.
Again, if the implication is that you might be doing this for life, be honest. Cover letters should emphasize the reasons why you would want a job, telling the truth about how your experience or your enthusiasm relates to the demands of that particular job, a cover letter. But if you go too far overboard claiming that you are a plumber, electrician, and a great orator, and you're really—
As well as a Speedo model.
and you're really just an extraordinary carpenter, it's not going to work out. There are going to be problems later.
And you're going to—
You're going to pay a price.
You're going to regret.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the most malleable world of narrative tales, where you can literally go out and make something up and materialize with the click of a mouse, social media.
I've said this before on this show. I am just amazed at what people are willing to say on social media sites, and we can name Facebook because it's the number one in the world. Not only do people expose who they are, but they also expose who they think they are, and sometimes those are not congruent. You know, they put themselves out there as something, and in their last post, they weren't that something. Just the frequency of posting on a site like Facebook reveals a lot about a person's life story. I've heard a lot of people say, where do they get the time to post so often? In other words, what's their real life story? If they were having so much fun, would they even have the time to post on Facebook? So just the number of postings on a social network, besides the privacy issue, tells a lot about a person's life story.
We're talking about our life stories and how we tell them to ourselves and others. Kansas City, have you ever looked at your own narrative and made changes to it? Join the conversation, 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org or on Twitter at KCURCST. Libby in Waldo, welcome to Central Standard. Libby? Libby's not there. How much of this, Dr. Bruce Lease, is about marketing our ideal selves, using dating and job searching as an example and social media as an example, as we just did? What's the difference between selling and telling?
I would hope that as a person matures in life and becomes increasingly confident and self-assured, I would hope that the marketing would go away. I would hope that the presentation of an ideal self that's not the same as the real self in somebody, I would hope that that would end as a person finds themselves, figures out who they are.
We're talking about personal narratives with Dr. Bruce Lease, the psychology behind our life stories. Libby and Waldo is there after all. Hello, yeah. Libby.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
I can.
Hi, Libby.
Okay. Hi. How are you doing, Dr. Lee? I have a different spin on telling one's life story, as I was telling your screener there. I've had an incredibly interesting, rich life, and I mean rich in terms of experiences. I consider that my wealth in life. And I'm also a blind individual, and I've been very, very fortunate to have met some of the people and have had some of the adventures I've had. However, something I'm dealing with, what if, and this is a what-if scenario, Dr. Lee, and maybe you can help me get through this, what if everybody that I've known have died that would be witnesses to what has happened, some of the things that's happened in my life, saying, I know exactly what she's talking about, I was there. They're no longer here. What does one do with those kinds of storytelling?
It's such a good question because as a population, obviously, we have the good fortune of aging. Our lifespan is greater than it was even when I was a kid. To me, one of the most terrifying things that does occur in a person's life is the loss of the people that matter to them. So regardless of your narrative, your life story, visually impaired or anything like that, the loss of those signposts, the people who tell us who we are and help us define ourselves, is a painful experience. There's always somebody out there that will be interested in hearing the story. If you present it in a way that shows that you're real and authentic and caring and all that stuff, if you present yourself in ways that are authentic, people want to hear your story. So you may lose people, but you'll gain people along the way.
So the way to change the narrative from Liberty's standpoint is if she's still the last woman standing of the people that she knew, and as people die off or leave, changing that narrative involves relating the story to someone who hasn't heard it yet.
Yeah, and there'll be somebody interested. I have a question for you, Libby. I just want to know, do people make assumptions about your narrative because you're not cited?
Sometimes. They may not vocalize their assumptions, but, you know, there's other ways that I pick up on. And I have a master's in counseling, so I'm kind of keen in on all this things I can't see, how to interpret body language and voice language and all that. But it's been something I have really been dealing with, and I've been asked to please write my story, to write a book someday, because of the vast experiences and the people I've met, and just it's been an incredible life. If I was to just drop dead right now, I guess you could say, I would honestly be able to say I have had one of the most interesting lives, and I have been exposed to some of the most amazing journeys that one human being could ever experience in a lifetime.
So people may assume that your life story, your narrative, is something that it's not. Well, thank you for answering my question.
No problem. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. What does her attitude towards her story demonstrate about her and what she's said about her story, how she's crafted her narrative? She says if she dropped dead today, she would have one of the most interesting lives that she knows of.
You know, I always go back, even though I am a cognitive behavioral therapist who focuses on the present far more than I focus on the past, there's a little voice in my head that always says something to me. I say to myself, there's something in that person's background people who have a very, very positive attitude, who believe the world is fascinating and awesome and wonderful, just that attitude itself creates a different kind of life than people who think negative things. And it all starts in childhood. The messages we get as kids become the first chapters of our narrative. The messages we get as children, as infants, are the first chapters of our narrative.
Moving on down the line, a big part of your narrative is inspired, in a sense, by your worldview or what you believe isn't true. Talk about that as well.
Well, as human beings, besides defining ourselves by our likes, we define ourselves by our dislikes. We look at the way other people live, and if we're healthy, we just say, that's not me. If we're unhealthy, in our minds, we try to pump ourselves up and ridicule others to make ourselves feel big. But you may see, on Sundays during football season, I see a lot of friends very busy listening to or watching football. I don't define myself in that same way, but I sure don't have bad thoughts about them because they are different from me.
We have a listener, Sergio, who writes in to talk about politicians. He says, and I quote, "Politicians, enough said." What does Dr. Lease think about the narratives that politicians use to tell the story of America? And then how does that shape one's own personal narrative?
This sure is an appropriate time to be thinking about that particular topic.
As election season gets underway.
Exactly. I once held elected office. I ran once, I was elected, and I didn't run again. I realized that it was going to require that I craft an ideal picture of myself for the rest of the time I'd be involved in any kind of elected office. Right now, I serve on a commission, and it's not an elected position; it's an appointed position, and it's on a planning commission. And it's just so nice to not have to worry about whether or not the public likes me. I just help make decisions about land use, and it's such a relief from having to cater to everybody's whims and wants and desires as to who I am.
And speaking of which, stories, life stories, don't usually involve projections for the future, but are based on what has already happened. And since personality of the present is some degree of manifestation based on memory, how much of our stories have a smattering of regret in them?
It really depends on how honest a person is with themselves. It's not possible to live a life where there isn't some regret. And it may be regret about something superficial like, not reading a book that everybody else is talking about. Or it could be something far more deep like not striving towards one's true goals or one's true self. So it's really wise to think about one's own regrets in a mindful fashion so that it's deliberate and constructive, and you ask yourself, first you think, I regret that I didn't go to that particular school that I really should have gone to. And the next thought might be, well, why didn't I? Let me try to understand who I was back then at that point in my narrative, and let me reconstruct my view of the past. Well, I didn't go there because at the time I wasn't ready, or I didn't have the money, or I was too afraid. So if there's a lot of self-judgment in the story, well, I was really stupid, I was lazy, that was such a crazy thing to do. If there's self-judgment, with that comes a lot of negative thinking. Alternatively, there can be a more compassionate, gentle kind of understanding about why we don't do what we say we're going to do and have regrets.
If there's too much of that, we can bring that regret into the present, sometimes literally, sometimes unwittingly. How do we move on from that regret?
Well, the glass half full, the glass half empty phenomenon is, as corny as it sounds, is a salient matter here. We get to look at the world however we want. Hopefully we maintain our objectivity and compassion for others, and even more important sometimes, our compassion for ourselves. I did this for a reason, and I now understand it, even though I have some regrets about that.
So in that sense, we should be constantly revising and reflecting in order to keep up with the present and prepare for the future.
I think that's right. I think without doing so, we become stagnant.
Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lees, professor of family medicine at KU. We're talking about our life stories, our personal life stories, and how we tell them to ourselves and to others. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, more storytelling of the personal narrative variety. Kansas City, what's the main theme of your personal narrative or life story? Do you believe it needs to change? If so, how do you think it needs to change? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're also on Twitter at KCURCST. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, "We're always coming up with the emphatic facts of history in our private experience and verifying them here. All history," he says, "becomes subjective." In other words, there is properly no history, only biography. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lees, professor of family medicine, and we're talking about, along the lines of Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay on history, our personal histories, our life stories, and how we tell themselves to ourselves and others. Kansas City, have you ever looked at your own narrative and made changes to it? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tell us your life story and how you want to change it, or what aspect of your life story you'd like to change. Once again, that number is 816-235-2888. Talk about this thing that Emerson talks about. All history becomes subjective, meaning it's your personal interpretation of how something happens.
Well, history is fascinating because it really is just the story as told by historians. During the last administration presidency, a lot of people just said, we're not going to know what history says about the president until it's written. It may be 20, 30 years. I'm sure that'll be the case with our current president. You don't know what history is until a historian writes it. On a more personal note, as I reflect back on my own history, my own story, there were so many different chapters. They're all still me. I'm a conglomeration of all those things. You know, I was poor at one time as a kid, and I'm not now. I worked as a dishwasher at one time, and I don't now. But I was a young man at one time, and I'm not now. Those are all part of my stories. If I were to tell any part of that story, when I was poor, when I was a dishwasher, when I was young, whatever, those are things are true, but they're just my subjective appraisal of that moment in time. Currently, I have a boat shop, so I'm a boat shop owner. But that's not all I do. I'm a teacher, so I teach. There are all these different things, and then how I process what those mean is what you're talking about.
Can you compare and contrast for us the differences between experience versus events? Events kind of happen to us. Experience is what we actually do. And how we respond.
To me, that's the fascinating part of psychology. There have been so many philosophers all the way back to Epictetus, who I believe was a fairly ancient philosopher who said it then, and we say it now. You know, it's not the events that happen in our lives. It's the way we understand them, the way we process them. So the experience of being poor and the experience of living a hard life early on can be understood as something terrible, awful, rotten, and no good, or it can be understood as something that builds character, and there are so many different variables that determine how that's all processed or understood.
Jesse writes into us at centralstandard@kcur.org. He says, "I find it very difficult to include my very difficult early life or my current messed up family in any narration of my life, but this ends up making me seem like a cipher to most people, a person who is suspect because they don't disclose much. What are some examples of how people can fully narrate their lives without seeming to dump it on others or to appear to be living in a past drama?" We touched a little bit on this, Dr. Bruce Lees. We tend to want to focus on the positive aspects of our life story, unless in some cases some of us tend to find more purpose in pain than in pleasure. But what do we typically leave out of our life stories, as our caller and listener, Jesse, points out?
Well, somebody who's skilled at reading others. We did a show here on emotional intelligence. Somebody who's skilled at reading others well will tell more of the whole story. If I'm talking to you and your eye contact is good and verbally you kind of follow, if I make a statement, it's obvious that you've heard it. If the listener is a good listener, it'll draw more truth out of us. If I start to talk to you about the suffering I experienced when I was young and your eyes glaze over or you check your watch or scratch your head or I can see you've gone someplace else emotionally, mentally, if I see that, I pick up on it, then I'm going to restrict how much I tell you that's more vulnerable. What he raises is the fact that disclosing personal pain, suffering, struggles, tragedies, disclosing that makes us more vulnerable to other people. They're more able to hurt us by being critical or even just losing interest.
What about Jesse's perception that a person who doesn't disclose much is automatically suspect? Inquiring minds want to know in this society.
If it's really obvious, then that's right. People, there's an optimum level of self-disclosure that we reach with every person we encounter. And if Jesse doesn't read that other people want to know more, dating would be an example. I would warn anyone, don't date somebody that isn't willing to reveal who they really are. It's you're going to find out things you didn't want to find out later. So there's an optimum level, and reading another person's body language, their attitude, etc., so you know who you can tell what to, is a real art.
You got Charlotte in Cameron. Welcome to Central Standard, Charlotte.
Well, thank you. I was triggered to call you by your question about changing a life story. I actually had the privilege of doing my grandmother's life story when she was in her 80s. She had been born in 1899 and was raised to believe that it was rude to talk about oneself. When she was a teenager, her mother would give her a daily assessment of her behavior by hanging either a black or a white button on a thread, and she would check the necklace to see how her mother had evaluated her that day. When I did her story in the 80s, she made a statement that prompted me to probe a little further, and she had judged herself very negatively for having negative emotions. When I probed further, I found that she'd had these three incredible tragedies between the time she was 17 and 27 that permanently affected her personality, had affected the way she raised my mother, and consequently affected me. By helping her reframe the way she looked at that and the way she judged herself, it had a cascade effect of changing my mother's narrative and changing mine.
Wow.
That's perfect. And I say that's perfect because I like to review the research on things we talk about on air here so that I'm just not shooting from the hip. And I just read a review article in a scientific journal, psychology journal, on the effects of self-disclosing and narratives in controlled situations. And what you describe is a very, very therapeutic process that has fairly reliably resulted in just a whole improved view of life. So what you did was clinically very well studied and understood, and you did something good for yourself by reviewing her life and understanding better how you came to be who you are through the generations.
In Charlotte's case, finding out something about her forebearer actually changed her narrative. Talk about that, these sort of discoveries we have about our childhood that we may not have known about that change our current circumstances or change the trajectory of our story.
Oh, and it can go either way. I have heard stories of people discover that a parent who is deceased, was having multiple affairs, and just hearing that part of the story really sours a person's view of that parent and has the potential to sour that person in general. Seeking an explanation that gives one peace as one goes into the past is just a good idea. I think if you're going to go to one of the websites that gives you the potential to look into your past, always do it with the decided that you want to learn good things. You might be disappointed, but hopefully not.
Melissa in Overland Park, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay.
All right.
I would like to talk about how, or just hear what you might say about. This happened to me 5 years ago. I was at a dear friend's house that I'd known since I was 20 years old, about 35 years. And she made three comments about three major events in my life. And she put a very negative spin on each thing, yet they were positive things, things to me, things that had, you know, some negatives built into them, but I felt positive about all of them. And as a consequence, I felt like she really didn't know me very well after all these years, and I backed away from the friendship. My two best friends are people who like the same things about me that I like about myself. But I feel, I just felt like I had to kind of release that other friendship.
Melissa calls in to talk about how her friends see her story. Talk about how our friends see our story, or people around us see our story, that may in effect change our story.
Sure. Back, I guess it was the 80s. I think it was back in the 80s, there was a book written, Road Less Traveled, by now a controversial writer named M. Scott Peck, and he did a beautiful job of reviewing all the literature on love. And he looked at, you know, The Art of Loving, Eric Fromm, et cetera, et cetera, looked at all of this stuff on love. And he summarized that love is nurturing one's own and others' growth, well-being, health, et cetera. When we love somebody, we do what we can, including ourselves, we do what we can to nurture what's good in them and help them get rid of what isn't good. That's a complicated order. That's a big, tall order, and it's very complicated. We often make friends with people so that we can share common interests. That's the way it starts. Church, synagogue, you know, on the baseball, you know, field or basketball court or wherever, mahjong table. We make friends based on sharing common interests. It's really important to push those friendships further, deeper, so that they become more substance and less just common interests. At times, one does find themselves very disappointed because it takes a lot of emotional intelligence and interpersonal skills to be a really good friend. So just because you play mahjong together doesn't mean the person that's across from you who plays well would really understand your life story or make good sense of it. So I, you know, all of us who seek good relationships have been disappointed at times when we figure out that the person who we think we've told our life story to doesn't get it. And so that's a normal, very, very normal reaction.
One of our listeners, Aaron, writes in, how does time affect the personal narratives? How do events become more or less accurate? Do we wear rose-colored glasses, so to speak? How do events become more or less accurate is the question posed by Aaron, one of our listeners at centralstandard@kcur.org.
This is a very complicated matter. There's been a lot of controversy over whether or not people remember crimes that have been committed against them. What we remembered is always influenced by the amount of emotion associated with it. And the more emotion, the more we're likely to distort it by perhaps magnifying it. We don't tend to remember a lot of trivial stuff that has no emotional importance to us. But, you know, if something happened when you were very young that was very big, you'll probably remember it. And if it wasn't very big, it's likely to fade. And by big, I mean emotional weight.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lease, professor of family medicine at KU. We're talking about our life stories and how we tell them to ourselves and others, our personal narratives. Kansas City, have you ever looked at your own personal narrative and made changes to it? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Dr. Lease, can you convince yourself that a narrative is true? And if so, how?
It happens all the time. And I'll tell you how it happens all the time. There are very few people that haven't been told stories about themselves when they were too little to remember. for example, you know, the time that your grandfather lifted the car off the man after the jack fell, and you know, and so part of your life story is you had this unbelievable heroic grandpa, or the time that you made, you know, a noise and 1,500 people in the auditorium all laughed. I mean, it may have been a noise in a little gym and there were five other kids there, but it grew to be 1,500. So the stories that we are told about ourselves, and also if you say the same thing over and over and over again, you're going to start to believe it, which is problematic, as you can imagine.
Which goes into how narratives might apply when it comes to addiction or substance abuse or some of the habits that are formed?
Yes, absolutely. I believe, as you mentioned earlier, that personality is all about memory. What we remember, what we think about the past is our memory. What we think about the past is our memory. And what we remember determines how we understand the world today. So if the only, if I have a mountain of memories about how great it is to go shopping when I'm unhappy, or if I have a mountain of memories about how comforting it was to overeat when I'm nervous or worried about something, if I have memories or thoughts that a maladaptive behavior will give me comfort, if that's part of my narrative, I'm likely to lean on that over and over and over again. And the repetition, you know, light a cigarette, eat a brownie, go buy something expensive, even though I don't need it. If it, the repetition of that giving immediate gratification becomes part of the life story. And so when people change bad habits, in a sense, they're changing their life story and their narrative.
What about dealing with depression in terms of your personal narrative? I've had such a sad life, so sadness is inevitable. I'm a product of my past. I'm a product of my environment. Talk about that.
It's interesting because there is no correlation between the number of tragedies in people's lives and how sad or unhappy they are. People weather trauma and pain differently. Everybody weathers suffering a little bit differently. And so somebody who is told in their early lifetime, you know, here's your life story, you know, the world's no good. There are people out to get us all the time. You're not going to do well at anything you do. Or in the case of a caller earlier, the only communication might be, were you good or bad today? That kind of background sets people up to be very self-critical and judgmental. And so that's where a lot of depression and anxiety comes from, messages about who we are that we then believe, and when they're negative, they are depressing.
How can changing our narratives help us form better habits?
Well, let's go back to the example of smoking, drinking, overeating, addictive shopping. When one, for example, loses weight and gets on an exercise program, they go from saying, you know, I don't want to starve myself now. Everybody else is enjoying dinner. They go from, you know, I need to indulge myself. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it, to, you know what, I'm not that person anymore. French fries are not me. French fries were me when I was a little kid, and we went out to fast food, and, you know, I got all I wanted, but that's not me anymore. I have a new story. And, you know, we're so intrigued by narratives, by stories about ourselves. I'm just so impressed by entire organizations that focus on narratives and life stories. StoryCorps.org, the people who come to us through public radio and KCUR, where people are interviewed and they just tell their story, are so intriguing. And Columbia University now has a College of Physicians and Surgeons program in narrative medicine. It's an entire master's program. And so physicians will listen to people's stories, not just their symptoms.
That's narrative medicine.
Narrative medicine, where it's a fancy way of saying to do what the proverbial old family doctors did when they did home visits. They sat and they listened to the story. They weren't in a rush to go see the next patient or to get the insurance claims filed.
Speaking of the narrative, talk about the role of sudden discovery or the concept of epiphany in the way we go about our personal narrative.
An epiphany is when one sees themselves differently from how they saw themselves a moment earlier. If you say to me, you really have, oh, so I've actually been told that I have a good radio voice. I didn't know I had a good, that was an epiphany. I always, like most humans, when I've heard my voice recorded, I sound like, to myself, I sound like a frog. So it's an epiphany is when you find something out about yourself that you just didn't know. It's different from a eureka moment where you find out something about the world. But to find out something about yourself, oh, I know why I do that. Or now I understand what I'm going to need to change in order to do better in life. Or, boy, I have not been the greatest parent. I've been yelling at my kids. That doesn't work. They just yelled back at me. So that's an epiphany, a realization about oneself.
We're talking about our life stories and how we tell them, our personal narratives and the psychology behind them. Chris in Overland Park, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, how are you guys?
Pretty good.
My question about narratives is my son was diagnosed as being autistic, or rather having Asperger's, when he was around 3.5 or 4 years old. And lately the medical community has sort of changed its mind about the spectrum and has changed his diagnosis. And my son finds himself around 10 or 11 now, and he's got a lot of questions about his own narrative. I mean, he's actually a little bit depressed about them changing the diagnosis because this affects his identity a lot. I just wanted to know how a young man who's disabled can change his narrative for the positive, and what you think about that.
Labels have a very important function in this world. They enable us to encapsulate an idea, a concept, a syndrome, very handily and quickly and easily. So whether it's a psychiatric, a medical, a flavor label, it gives us an image very quickly. Some labels carry with them a lot of emotional weight, and a psychiatric label or a medical label will carry a lot of weight. And a lot of people aren't ready for the weight of that. I would say that a child really isn't. Their brain development, their cognitive development isn't great enough with sufficient abstraction skills. They're not prepared well for those kinds of labels. So when I work with parents with kids who are having any kind of difficulty, I try to stay away from the labels. As a psychologist, a licensed practicing psychologist and professor, I teach the labels all the time because they do have a place. But I would advise strongly that a child who's been given a label is told, you know what, stop thinking about the label and let's just pay attention to what works for you and what doesn't work for you. The label is not for a pre-abstract thinker, a child, a 10-year-old. It just isn't.
How can narratives be a tool for healing?
In lots of ways.
Journaling, for instance.
Journaling is a way, as long as what you're journaling isn't how terrible your life is. If all you journal about is he did me wrong and she did me wrong and I got pulled over by the police today and it really sucked and I hate my life, that's not good journaling. But writing down events, thoughts, and feelings and then trying to reconstrue them or think about them differently so that they bring one less pain is a really good idea.
So you can actualize complaining or actualize that way of thinking if you write a journal about being miserable.
Yeah. When I have gotten tickets for driving stupidly, maybe I've gone too fast. Fortunately, it really hasn't happened in a while. But my first thoughts probably for the rest of the day are pretty self-critical and negative and I can't believe I did that, or why wasn't I paying attention, etc. A good example of journaling would be to write down, I got a ticket today. Here's how I feel about it. Here's what I think. And then in the next column, I'd write, here's what I've learned from my mistakes, and here's how I'm going to be different.
So it would be solution-oriented.
Solution-oriented. That's a good way to put it. The glass is half full, half empty, and if it's half empty and you're thirsty, finish it and fill it up next time.
How would we start our narrative if we were starting our narrative today? If we needed to practice changing our narrative right now, how would we begin?
I think everybody's different. Some people like to write down memories. Some people like to write down long-term memories. Some people like to write down short-term memories. Again, who we are is a function of our memories, what we think about our past and how we've come to be who we are. So if the memories that are most salient or most in the forefront of your mind are how the day went, write those. If you're trying to remember your mom, your deceased mom, if your mom passed, you might start writing down the color of her hair and the smell of her perfume and you know, moments when you know, she gave you a hug or gave you advice. Or if you want to write down what happened to you today, that's just as important if that's what's on your mind.
Dr. Lee, should our life stories be geared more toward what we want people to say about us when our time is up, or what we want to have accomplished before this linear thread ends?
I've said this before. I'll say it many times again. Before my time is up, the two most important reasons for being on Earth are to find meaning, to figure out why we're here for us, not us as a species, but each of us individually. Writing one's narrative should be a process of finding out, determining, deciding who we are and shaping that as we go along. That's one reason to be alive, and another good reason to be alive is to love well. So I would like, when people tell my story, that they say, that guy Lee, he figured a few things out. He really worked hard to make sense of the world. And I'd like even more for people to truly feel like I've loved them well and they've loved me. Not primarily in the romantic sense, obviously, because that's reserved for just my wife and I. But I want people to feel like I love them well and they love me well, the people who I've drawn closest to me.
Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lee, professor of family medicine at KU. We're talking about our life stories, our personal narratives, and how we tell them to ourselves and others, and also how we can change them and start over with constant revision. Dr. Lee, thank you for joining us.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
And tune in tomorrow for a history of the street insult game that goes all the way back to Jelly Roll Morton and Zora Neale Hurston and NWA, to name a few. It's called The Dozens, and the game goes like this. Yo mama is so... We'll save that for tomorrow. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a look at the future of women in politics. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.